Jason Capper here, asking you to help us save the C-53 Beat City Baby from the scrapper's torch. Folks, every dollar goes directly towards the restoration so that we can fly her again. Donate now at www.vintagewingsinc.com. That's vintagewingsinc.com. Our time is limited, and the need is now. So again, please go to www.vintagewingsinc.com. And help us save our C-53 Beat City Baby.
Live from the land of the free, because of the brave, this is Warbird Radio.
Well, welcome to the Wings Over New Zealand live show here on Warbird Radio for June 2016. I'm your host, once again, Dave Homewood. And unfortunately, again, my co-host Grant can't make it to the show. He's actually got a good excuse this month. He's in Canberra, in the capital of Australia, at a defence industry conference. So we thought we'd let him off this month. But so it's going to be me just by myself once again. But we'll be joined fairly soon with a very interesting guest. So before we get to the guest, though, we'll... go to a little bit of Warbird news. Now, here in New Zealand with the Warbird news, there's not a lot happening at the moment because it's midwinter. But a week and a half ago, I went to an excellent air show at Ardmore. It was the New Zealand Warbirds Open Day, which they have twice a year. And it was an absolutely brilliant event. The weather was excellent. It started with a very crisp frost in the morning, which warmed up to a really sunny and warm day. And that allowed for a lot of good flying, and a lot of aircraft turned up. I mean, there's a lot of aircraft based there at Ardmore, but there's a number of aircraft come from around New Zealand as well to join in, or at least to just sit static on the display line so people could have a look at them. And they do a wonderful job there at Ardmore with these little open days. And when I say little, this particular one was a massive open day because the good weather brought half of Auckland out, I think, and I think they got more than four times the amount of people that they were planning for, which has got to be great because, you know, the more people through the gate, the more money they're raising for their Warbird display in the hangar there, and that's what these things are all about. But probably the real highlight for me was seeing the New Zealand Catalina back in action flying at the air show. Listeners to the show will remember that back in, probably about a year ago now, we had some of the Catalina crew on the show here talking about its restoration and how it was going. Well, it's now back in the air. I think I mentioned it on the last show that it was displaying down at Wanaka and doing ride flights down there. Yeah, it was great to see it back up in Auckland where it used to live, and it looks stunning. It looks magnificent, actually. It's better than I've ever seen it before, and this aircraft's been on our scene for, I don't know, maybe 25 years now. I'm not entirely sure, but it's been around a long time, and it really looks good. So well done to that team. It looks better than I've ever seen it before, and it's new paint job and just looks fantastic. Great to see it back in the air. Another excellent development at that little open day too was that the Royal New Zealand Air Force turned up with some of their aircraft. They had a couple of the new Texan II trainers, which are very impressive. One of them displayed just brilliant. It was a brilliant display. They've flown a couple of times at air shows in the past, but they've been very flat, very boring displays. This one, the pilot really put it through its paces, and this is the first time I think they've done that in New Zealand. So they're obviously getting used to these aircraft, and, really good to see. And there was also an NH-90 helicopter and a King Air there on static display. And, boy, they got a lot of interest at the Air Force section. What a great recruiting tool it is to have those aircraft at the open day. And now what else has been happening? Oh, last Sunday, I went up to the Auckland War Memorial Museum to the Royal Air Force Bomber Command Commemorative Service, which is an annual event. And it's really just a bit like an Anzac Day service, but it's just to remember the Bomber Command members who never came home, and it's always a very moving service, and it has representatives from many of the allied countries speaking and representing, and that was just great, and it was good afterwards to meet up with some of the Bomber Command veterans who are all now well into their 90s, and have a chat with some of them and meet some that I hadn't met before, because a lot of them I had, and that was just brilliant. I've got photos on Facebook of both these events, so if anyone wants to have a look at the photos from these events, you can go and have a look on the Facebook page. The only other bit of news lately here in New Zealand is I see that the Flying Heritage Collection have released a photo earlier this week of their Mosquito, which is under restoration at Ardmore at Avspex. I actually visited that project a few weeks ago when I was up at Ardmore, and I have to say it's extremely impressive to see it coming together. It's as good as looking at KA-114 a couple of years ago. And this is their second Mosquito that they're restoring to flight, and it is hopefully going to be flying within the next couple of months. So watch the space. We'll keep you informed on developments there. As I mentioned earlier, Grant has got a leave pass this month, but he's actually been good enough to record a couple of pieces for this episode, and he's sent us the following clip about the warbird scene, what's happening across the Tasman in Australia. So if Matt can please play the clip.
Hi, Dave. My apologies that I can't join you today for the live Wings Over New Zealand show, but unfortunately I'm at a conference in Canberra with my day job. So you're going to have to do it without me once again. Hopefully next time I'll be able to join in the fun and record live with you as normal. But just to kick things off from here in Australia, I thought I'd give you the latest warbird news that I've got for you. First one is that six ex-Royal Australian Air Force caribous that had been in storage in Oakey at the Army Aviation Centre, plus also one at Brisbane Airport, are in the process of being dismantled by volunteers from various organisations who are receiving them, getting them ready for their trips around Australia. The Historic Aircraft Restoration Society at Wollongong have obtained two more caribous. These will be kept static and possibly used for parts for their two flying caribous. They won't be kept at Wollongong, though. They'll be at Haar's other location inland New South Wales. Removal of the engines, wings, tails and rear fuselages off these aircraft is keeping everyone very occupied, especially as it's being done in sometimes rather trying conditions of rain and wind and a bit of mud. But one of the aircraft is staying at Oakey for the Australian Army Flying Museum. The others are going to various preservation groups around the country for static display. Now, there's no news on the Hawker Hurricane that's being restored at Pays in Scone, which is a shame, as we last heard it was getting very close to going up once again. So there were some people hoping it was going to be flying earlier this year, but I guess, as with everything, she's flying when she's ready, and it's just getting it all finalised. But Pays in Scone are also restoring a Spitfire, used to have the registration MH603. That restoration is continuing, but of course it's got a long way to go, and I believe it's being done around the work on the Hurricane. So hopefully the Hurricane should have been painted by now, and there was going to have been a bit of an unveiling of that. So looking forward to hearing more and reporting on it in the near future. The Qantas Founders Museum in Longreach in Queensland and Outback Queensland have dismantled the super constellation that they purchased at Manila Airport that had been left rotting over there. And they've got it dismantled and stored ready for transport back to Australia, where it's going to undergo restoration to static condition in Qantas colours. The museum is attempting to raise $1.5 million to cover the costs of freighting the aircraft. In other news, an ex-Royal Australian Air Force Hawker Demon is currently under restoration in Caboolture, with very good progress being made. Operated by the Royal Australian Air Force between 1935 and 1948, the Hawker Demons were obsolete by the outbreak of World War II and were relegated to target towing, training and communications work. And speaking of Haas at Wollongong, the Wings Over Illawarra Air Show was held a few months ago, and they finally broke the bad weather jinx and put on 2 days of great flying. There's a little bit of rain on both days and some wind on the Sunday, which unfortunately kept Trapo from flying his Sabre. But a lot of great aircraft got off the ground, and it was a great couple of days. I had a blast doing airshow commentary there, and it was really good to see after 2 years of the airshow having to be cancelled. They tried it 1 year, but the wind stopped almost every aircraft they had there from flying. Just a couple of jets managed to do a display. And then last year it was rained out with torrential rain practically flooding the airport, having to cancel that. But the organisers kept at it, and they've managed to get third time lucky, a fantastic air show. So that's it from here. Hope you're having fun over there, and we'll look forward to catching up on the next live show. Cheers, mate.
Well, that's really good. There's obviously lots and lots happening across the Tasman in Australia, and I'm really pleased to hear of all the interesting things happening at Haas. They've got an amazing collection there and good group of people. Now, today's theme is actually on the RNZAF Iroquois helicopter, and the main reason we've picked today for that, because today's the 50th anniversary to the day of the arrival of the first Iroquois helicopter into New Zealand. Now, Grant knew that the Iroquois was going to be the theme of today's show, so he's actually recorded another little piece that we'll play just before we get into the New Zealand story about the Australian Iroquois with the Royal Australian Air Force. So here's Grant again.
G'day, Dave. I thought I'd take a couple of minutes just to let you know my thoughts on the Huey, the notorious Bell UH-1. Beyond my recollections of growing up with that beautiful waka waka sound in New Zealand and Australia, over here in Australia, the UH-1B was first picked up by the Royal Australian Air Force in October 1962, and it was used for search and rescue duties here in Australia. Eventually, a number of them were deployed to Malaysia during 1964 to provide support during the confrontation with Indonesia. From there, a number of the Hueys went over to Vietnam in May 1964, and they were in use quite extensively in Vietnam with everyone else. And the Aussies received a few more UH-1Ds. They were subsequently upgraded to UH-1H standard. More new UH-1H helicopters were ordered and delivered directly to Vietnam. Now, this allowed the B models to come back to Australia, where once again they went on to search and rescue duties at various RAF bases around Australia. Since the end of Vietnam, when the Hueys came back to Australia, in addition to working with deploying troops and so on around Australia and on exercises, RAF UH-1s have also served with the UN in the Middle East during the 70s and 80s, doing peacekeeping duties, and they've performed survey operations in the remote areas of Papua New Guinea and Indonesia. The last Royal Australian Air Force UH-1 flight was actually back in 1985 when a B model was flown to Canberra for the Australian War Memorial, and a number of the older Bs and Ds and so on were put into storage and sold. Some have wound up in museums and so on, but the remaining 25 UH-1H models were transferred to the Australian Army and operated until September 2007 when the last one was finally retired. So quite a workhorse in the country and in the area and Asia and so on, and the Middle East. I've done sterling service, first with the Royal Australian Air Force, then across the Army, and these final ones, the final H models, some are being sold, some are being scrapped, a few have wound up in museums and so on. Yeah, not just the Air Force and Army flying the H models, the Royal Australian Navy flew the UH-1B and the UH-1C from 1964, and you also found Royal Australian Navy aircrew flying American UH-1s from 1967 until 1971 in Vietnam as part of the US Army's 135th Assault Helicopter Company. Some good stories of the guys operating under Taipan call signs, and the flight's motto was "Get the bloody job done," so good motto for them. They had a pretty good reputation in Vietnam. And the Royal Australian Navy wound up operating UH-1s until May 1989, and one is kept with the Royal Australian Navy's historic flight, and is quite often seen around at air shows. But that's a quick little nutshell summary of the Huey and its use here in Australia with both the Air Force, the Army, and the Navy. So a very popular workhorse aircraft, that one for sure. And I'll pass it back to you, mate. I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of the show when it's available as a podcast. Cheers, mate.
Well, thanks very much, Grant, for those segments. It's interesting to hear the Iroquois story from the other side of the Tasman, and it's fairly similar to what happened here with the multi-roles that our Iroquois flew as well. And now I'd like to introduce our guest for today's show. Our guest today is Des Jide, who has a long association with the Iroquois, and he actually started off in the mighty safety and surface trade, which was actually my trade during my time in the Air Force, and he then went to helicopter crewman trade and flew in the back of the helicopters as one of the key men in the helicopters. And to mark the 50th anniversary today of the arrival of the Iroquois, we're going to discuss it at New Zealand service with Des's memories. Hi, Des.
G'day there, Dave. How are you doing?
Great, great. It's really good to have you on the show.
And thanks very much for inviting me. I'm feeling quite privileged to be able to speak on behalf of the squadron and its involvement with the Iroquois.
Oh, no problem. I mean, it was such an important aircraft for so long, and it was really an icon of the Air Force. I think everybody in the country must have seen one at least once, because they seem to be everywhere. We only had 16 in total in service, but you know, they seemed to be everywhere, didn't they?
Yes, they did. They got around a fair bit, and if you didn't see them, you could quite often hear them coming from miles away. They made their made themselves known to everybody and sundry for miles around.
Absolutely. What were your first impressions when you first saw an Iroquois?
Sort of mixed, really. I wasn't too sure. I was keen to go and fly helicopters as such, because I'd been involved with private flying before I joined the Air Force, and then I got into the Air Force hoping to go direct into being a pilot, but I missed out university entrance exam by 9 marks, so I wasn't able to qualify for UE, and so I had to do a ground trade, which was actually worked out pretty well. In that time, I found that it wasn't all that I thought it was, in that being a pilot, I would do an ab initio flying training, and then I'd move to a squadron and convert onto whichever aircraft they were flying. And then I would get probably 2 years of flying, or three if I was very, very lucky, before I was taken off flying duties to go into an office job to do my command and staff training requirements as being an officer. So in lieu of that, I chose to go the non-pilot air crew way, but the door was never ever closed on me as far as reapplying to be a pilot.
Right.
So they were a really neat aircraft to be involved with. Straight off my fitters course at Hobsonville, I moved 200 metres down the airfield to 3 Squadron 2, take up my job there in the safety and surface trade. And I must say that coming straight from the school to an operational squadron where the facilities were very, very basic compared to the school, I was put under quite a bit of pressure with trying to get the right finish on the products that we were painting, especially when they moved us down to the southern end of the hangar for our work, because they had to replace the rails in the northern end of the hangar. So it was very cold, damp, very unpleasant working conditions, and very difficult to get the prime finish on your products that you were trying to repaint.
Yeah, now I should actually explain for most of the listeners out there won't know what safety and surface did. It was actually, unlike any other Air Force in the world, it sort of combined several trades into one. And the safety element was safety equipment like parachutes, life rafts, life vests, helmets, all that sort of thing. And then the surface was the painting, as you were saying. And you know, we did all the aircraft painting, didn't we?
That's right. And also that included the upholstery and fabric work in the aircraft as well. So it covered a lot of trades, basically, and it was the tail end, Charlie, of the technical trades. Basically, we picked up the slack for all the other trades, and we did all of these other jobs. It was quite a neat trade, because you actually saw a lot of things that you'd produced and done firsthand. It was great taking an airplane and stripping it right down and then repainting the whole thing and getting an end result and seeing that around it, and even to the other degree of producing signs for around base or wherever, you know, your signage was up there for years and years and years, and it was great to, you know, doing a finished product and taking it from go to woe. So yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was quite good.
Exactly. And also with the upholstery side of it too, you were creating designs and creating things that had – like every day you were doing something different in that trade. I think a lot of the others, like avionics and the aircraft technicians, they're just really fitting parts and unfitting parts. You know, they're doing stuff that's already been manufactured, and we were very creative in our trade. But
indeed, and my course in safety equipment, the surface finishing course that I did, which was turned out to be my senior trade course, was the last course that got taught how to do fabric covering of aircraft components, and because it was becoming less and less of a requirement as we got the newer aircraft coming through, and during our time at the school we completely recovered a Ron Lurk glider. We not only covered it and did all the sewing and whatnot that goes with it, but we painted it with the lacquered dope paints that we were using, and got it all signed and everything. It was a very hands-on sort of a thing that we did, but we saw a fantastic result. And sadly, we didn't sort of put those skills to too much use once we got back onto the operational side of our job.
Right, right. Yeah, not a lot of fabric on the Iroquois, is there? So.
No, there's not.
Now, you were here the other night about the morning parade. Tell me about the morning parade.
Oh, yes, this was within the first year of being on the squadron. We used to have morning parades where there was a roll call, and then we'd have a bit of a brief as to what work was going to be done on this particular day. And Paddy Keane was the sergeant who was doing this particular morning parade, and he said, "Now I'd like you to turn around and sing happy birthday to Iroquois 03, which is still sitting here in the corner of the hangar where it's been for basically the whole year. And what had happened was that this aircraft had developed an unusual vibration, and they hadn't been able to figure it out. They'd changed all of the moving parts of the aircraft. They'd done super jobs on balancing blades and paint jobs and all sorts of things, but they couldn't figure out what the problem was. It transpired some months later, I think 1 or 2 months after first birthday celebration of it being grounded, that they found that the problem was a delamination of the two main beams that run under the floor, front to back of the Iroquois, upon which everything else is built off. And these had started to delaminate and had set up this unusual vibration. So, in true Kiwi style, we contacted Bell Textron and said we'd like some main beams for our Iroquois that's got this delamination problem. And they said, "You want what?" We said, "Yeah, you want what? You just buy an airframe, sir. You don't bother about changing. You know how many rivets are in that aeroplane to take those things out and put them back in. Yes, we're well aware of how many rivets we've got to get rid of and how many to go back. But as it transpired, we got these main beams, but then we did a survey of the other aircraft. Because all of these Iroquois were bought at the same time, they basically had flown the same amount of hours.
Yep.
And this was part of the technical control system that we had. So we found a few others that were starting to delaminate as well. So at one stage, we had about three or four Iroquois with their tails off and transmissions out and rotors off, etc., up on all sorts of drums and trestles and things where these main beams were being changed. It looked like a manufacturer's shed rather than an operational squadron.
Right. I mean, it almost makes you think because that the Air Force went to that much trouble to change them out and completely restart again with the main beams, that may well have extended the life of the aircraft, so that's why they flew for nearly 50 years, I guess.
Well, it certainly did, yes, and there were known problems with the aircraft, especially up around the 90-degree gearbox. There was a tendency to crack in that area, and so we had a painted area of white on that part of the aeroplane. So during inspections of the aircraft, pre-flight especially, and also after flights, we could see if there were any cracks had developed in that particular area. Now, this was because the rotor, tail rotor, worked in the way it did. If they had upgraded the aircraft and changed them so that the tail rotor was on the other side, it wouldn't have been so much of a problem. But anyway, we lived with this problem, as we did with the cracking that we used to get on the left-hand side top area of where the tail rotor mounted to the back of the airframe. Yep. That had a tendency to crack in there. So all of these known things were monitored very, very closely. And as I said to you the other day, flying in the aircraft, we got used to what was normal vibration and sound of the aircraft, and if you noticed anything slightly different, all of a sudden you would take notice and do something about it.
Right.
And so
how often would that come up? How often would you have a problem maybe with the rotor blades or anything like that? Would that be a rare thing? Or
yeah, it was fairly rare, although on some occasions, some of these things that happened at a certain hours after the aircraft had gone into operation. And so when other aircraft got to the same stage, we were sort of looking out for them, and we picked up problems before they actually got too severe. So, yes, once again, having bought all of the aircraft at the same time, you had the same problems happening around about the same time over all of the aircraft, not just one aeroplane. It wasn't just an isolated case. So it was just one of the vagaries of helicopters and in the way that they operate compared to a fixed-wing aeroplane.
Right, okay. And so tell me about the helicopter maintenance squadron itself at Hobsonville.
Yeah, that was a sort of a funny sort of a situation born out of the 1950s, 60s era, because we're sort of tied to the British way of doing things, and so we kept the operational side separate from the maintenance side, and neither the twain shall meet terribly closely. Although we had a tendency to operate very closely with the helicopter maintenance squadron, who were effectively three squadron anyway, but three squadron was really the operational side of flying the aeroplane, whereas the helicopter maintenance squadron did all of the maintenance on it, and they sort of did their own thing. And so, yeah, it was a funny sort of a situation, and fortunately things have sort of changed over the years to become more integrated and accountability is a big factor. We have to budget on what we can afford to do and what we can't afford to do as a squadron. And the squadron is the whole thing. It's the maintenance and it's the operational thing. It goes into all sorts of facets as well. So yeah, it changed a great deal in the last 20, 30 years.
Right. Okay. Now you changed trades from safety and surface to become a helicopter crewman, which is the guy that's in the back doing the winching, and you've got a lot of control over what actually happens on the aircraft, haven't you, in terms of letting the pilots know where to go and all that sort of thing, haven't you?
All the pilots have to do is sit in those two front seats and fly the aeroplane. Yes, they have to do a bit of navigation. Yes, they have to do a little bit of radio work, but that's about it. The crewman in the back, on the other hand, is not always in a seatbelt. He's usually in a safety harness attached to some hard point on the back of the aeroplane. So if you got thrown about a bit, you had to be very careful because you could hurt yourself. But you did all sorts of things of giving clearances on the out the side of the airplane through the cargo open cargo door for the side that the pilot that was flying the airplane was operating. So it was the guy, the captain of the aircraft who was in the right-hand seat flying, then you're out the right-hand door. If it was a co-pilot flying, you're out the left-hand door, and the other pilot was taking care of clearances on the non-flying pilot side of it. We did the winching. We did the observation and calling of the underslung load work, attaching and detaching and clearances, etc. Winching people and supplies, doing the maintenance on the aircraft when it was away from base. And also during flight, we were doing helping with the navigation, and we were also monitoring the aircraft performance and engine instrumentation like a flight engineer would do in one of the bigger aircraft. So there was a lot of facets to the job. You're loading and unloading people and making sure that the weight and balance of the airplane wasn't upset by having too much heavy stuff on one side or the other. If you couldn't get away from that, and if it wasn't unsafe, then you would actually do your call to the pilot that all secure aft and we are heavy right, meaning that there's a little bit of extra weight on the right-hand side. Or else if the weight was good all around, it was nice and even, we'd say weight's good.
Okay.
So there was a lot of interaction on HF radio between the aircraft and base or whoever we were working with, and that was done by the crewman as well.
Okay. And one of the most sort of public aspects of your role in the Iroquois was search and rescue. Tell me about some of the more memorable search and rescue missions that you guys did.
I guess the most memorable of all was the first one, which was out on the East Cape of the North Island of New Zealand in very rugged, steep country, very bush, heavily bush-clad area where a hunter and his brother had become separated because the younger guy, who was inexperienced in the bush, had twisted his ankle and was moving quite slowly. So his brother said to him, the experienced guy said, "Look, I'll just shoot down to the hut, get the fire going, just come down at your own pace and I'll see you there soon." Hours passed by and this guy didn't turn up, and after doing his own search in the day that followed, he came out and raised the alarm, and we went in to an old disused farmhouse which was right next to a long paddock which had been a top dressing airstrip, and that's where we based ourselves. And from there we were taking five parties of four searches into various places in the local area. We moved these guys around, and it was a day-long job. You no sooner picked up one lot and put them somewhere else that you're picking up another lot and picking them somewhere else, and then at the end of the day you're going out and picking up all of these guys and bring them back to the headquarters.
Yep.
The first day was miserable, wet, raining, low visibility, low cloud, wind, all of the stuff that you wouldn't want in such close territory like it was out there. But anyway, we got back to Opotiki, which is 20 minutes flying time from where we were operating, and went to the hotel, and we were drenched to the skin. The people at the hotel were absolutely lovely, and they said, look, just throw your gear in here and we'll look after it. And in the morning it was all nice and dried and pressed and everything, so it was all good. But anyway, cut a long story short, sorry. The next day we continued the search, and had by 4 o'clock had found nothing. I was on the HF radio to Auckland to see whether they would like us to remain in the area or come back to base. They went away to find out what the requirement was. So then, just as I was waiting for that, I saw this figure coming down the paddock towards the aeroplane. So I got out and I said, "Excuse me, but you wouldn't be so-and-so, would you?" And he said, "Yeah, are you guys looking for me?" And I said, "Yes, we are looking for you." "I'm glad that you're okay. Are you okay?" And he said, yeah, "I'm fine. How did you find us?" And he said, "Oh, I just heard the Iroquois around the area." And he said, and I had noted where it was going to most of the time, so I guess that's where you guys were operating from. So here I am. So well done. So we found the guy.
Brilliant.
So that was brilliant. Yeah. Successful. So.
Now, you did a lot of work with the Army and the Navy and police and other groups, didn't you?
Yes, we did. We did a lot of work with the Army, and that was mostly centred at Wairua in the centre of the North Island, and very cold, trying conditions. It was interesting, too, when we were doing this work, we were normally operating with the cargo doors closed. And so when we were training the Army guys on M-plane, D-plane drills, the situation was that the two guys closest to the doors were responsible for opening the doors,
yep,
letting the other guys out, and then closing the doors, and then going out and going to ground, facing outwards, protecting the aeroplane, obviously.
Yep.
One time this didn't happen, and one of my pilots said, "Boy, we should really go out there and kick that guy right up the backside." And I said, "Yep, I'm on my way." Undid myself from my harness and disconnected from the intercom, and I went out there and I gave him a bit of a boot up the backside. It wasn't terribly hard and injured him, but I said, "And don't you ever get out of the airplane without closing the door again." Briefed it. "Yes, Sarge. No, Sarge. Yeah." Anyway, got back into the aeroplane, and the pilot said, "I don't really mean you to go out there and do it." And I said, "Well, I have." And I said, "I've got the message through." And I said, I don't think he will forget to close the door again, nor will his other mates either, because they won't want to be booted up the ass by a helicopter crewman that's not too happy with them. But the Army, by and large, were very, very happy to see us in all situations that we were involved with them, because it meant that they didn't have to walk great distances like they had done in the past without the helicopter support. They got fed and watered. They got resupplied. So it was, they looked upon us quite lovingly, to put it mildly. They really did like us being involved with their operations, that's for sure.
Right. And what about one of the other roles that probably a lot of people don't know about was carrying VIPs as well?
Yes, we did carry VIPs from time to time, and that was an interesting change. We had a kit that could be fitted to the aircraft. Now, the floors had very thick plywood panels that went onto the floors. It was in two halves, one for the right side, one for the left side. And this was just to spread the load over the honeycombed flooring of the Iroquois, saving damage to the actual floor. And they worked very, very well. But what we had was we had one set of these boards with red carpet upholstered onto them. We had nice, soft upholstered seats which went on the normal troop seats and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, we would change the aeroplane into just a little bit more presentable for our VIP guests, whoever they were. So we did that sometimes. So
would that normally be for, like, members of Parliament or a Prime Minister, that sort of thing?
Mostly for members of Parliament and the Prime Minister and visiting heads of state, etc. Not very often for royal family members, although they didn't balk at coming flying with us when they did, but it was few and far between. They used to use the bigger aircraft usually for those sorts of people.
Right. So one of the things that was always a bit of fun is the annual exercises, and I know that the Iroquois had several annual exercises, and I think even now the squadron is still running those exercises with the NH90s, but tell us about those.
Yeah. Firstly, we had Tropic Concert, which was the hot weather tropical exercise up in Fiji. That was meant to be straight out training for us in hot climates. Because of all of the performance of the aeroplane was changed quite dramatically at altitude and hot weather.
Yep.
So we had to familiarise ourselves with that. But we didn't get to do much training per se, in so much as we used that time to do civil aid work for the Fijian government, helping villagers to put in water reticulation schemes and take in building supplies to replace buildings that had been bowled over by hurricanes or whatever. So it was a good PR exercise for New Zealand to have such a utility aircraft that could do all of that. Interesting enough, when we finished with our exercise, 75 Squadron with the Skyhawks used to come up for 2 weeks of exercise doing much the same sort of thing, but they couldn't do anything but charge around the sky all day long and didn't help anybody but just made a big noise and looked flash. But but enough talk about them. This is about helicopters, and I'd like to get back to that. It's sort of contentious, sort of a role strike. It even when I was on 5 Squadron in latter years, they were a bit of a waste of space, really. So they weren't a working aircraft like the Iroquois, Hercules, or the Orion, and so I didn't have much time for them. So we'll just leave it at that, shall we? Otherwise, it might get a little bit political. We don't want that, do we?
Then there was the winter exercise too at Molesworth Station, wasn't it? And,
yes.
Exercise Blackbird, wasn't it?
Exercise Blackbird, and that's where you go up into the Alps and to the high country. It's cold. It's high altitude sort of stuff, and we did all sorts of training as to the best way to approach the top of mountains and approaches and all that sort of thing, picking up simulated survivors off the snow. We had one called Idi Amin, a big gorilla looking chap that we'd made up, a large Guy Fawkes almost, but he had this gorilla face on him anyway.
Yep.
And we called him Idi. And so Idi was tossed out of the aeroplane unceremoniously on many occasions, and then another crew had to go in there and try and figure out how they're going to recover Idi. And on some occasions they could just winch somebody down, put a strop around him and winch him back up. Other times they had to go down with a stretcher litter, put him into the litter, tie him all up properly, and then lift them away. All those sorts of scenarios were played out. So it was a very, very useful tool because we had such a lot of work to do in this in the Alps and the South Island, especially for search and rescue. Because you've got to remember that up until the late 80s, the Air Force was responsible for virtually all of the helicopter search and rescue operations that went on throughout New Zealand.
Yeah.
And then some sideways-looking government got in, and they thought there wasn't fear that the civvy operators were missing out on this because they could be making an extra bit of money through search and rescue. So we sort of took a back seat, but we did so willingly, and but we were asked to be on standby just in case the civvy operators found it too difficult and said, no, we're not going in there. And then we would go in and we would do it. To our credit, on one of our search and rescue exercises down near Te Anau at the bottom of the South Island, up the Eglinton Valley, which is the valley that you go up to when you want to go to Milford Sound, and there's a bit of a plug for New Zealand tourism. We did the search and rescue exercise up there with the local volunteers and all that sort of thing. And one of the big helicopter operators down there. Yes.
Hello, Dave.
We're back.
Yeah, you dropped off there.
Dropped off. So anyway, we got back from this scenario, and Bill, who was an extremely experienced helicopter operator, spanning 30 years or more, said, well, he said, I'll take my hats off to you guys. He said, I just wouldn't be prepared to go in and do what you've just done. And he said, and to do it so well, he said, good on you. You said, you've got my tick in the box, he said. I'll take my hat off to you. Well done. And we said, well, we're training to do this all the time. This is what we train to do, and that's why we are able to do this sort of stuff. Yeah, so these exercises were always very well thought out and played out to great effect for everybody involved, be it the air crew or the maintenance guys that were involved. It was great. One of the exercises that we did way back, and it was about 1980, was the last exercise where the US Army guys that were based in Hawaii came across to New Zealand for an annual exercise that had been going on for years called Triad.
Oh, yes.
These guys were super combatant sort of guys. You know, it was all gung-ho sort of stuff, but, you know, they were armed to the teeth. They had the mission all sorted out. One of the events that we did with them was we went out and located each of these groups, a group of five troops at various points in the Wairu area. In our case, we landed with the toe of the left skid just touching on the side of this hill where these guys were. They very carefully got on the aircraft on the left-hand side and moved across to the right and got strapped in, and off we went. We all met up with the other three aircraft. We were the fourth aircraft in this formation, so we landed last. And as we dropped off these guys, they were out there, guns blazing. It was just all on. There was thunder flashes going off everywhere. It was a full-on attack, and we took off. And the other three departed back to Wairu, and we had been asked to stay behind and fly over this particular area and throw thunder flashes to simulate battle noise. And when we ran out of the thunder flashes, we were then to throw smoke grenades, so that was fine. So we had this racetrack pattern, and the area that we had been designated for us to throw these into was from the southern edge of this house across its roof and into an area behind it on the northern side.
Yep.
So I then started throwing smoke grenades. And the last smoke grenade that I threw actually hit the side of the house. And I went, oh, bugger. And the pilots, you don't say that to pilots. They go, what's wrong with the airplane straight away? Nothing was wrong.
Yeah.
I said, sorry, I just got the smoke grenade a little bit too close to the edge of the designated area, but it hit the house, so that was okay. We got back to Wairu, and an hour or so later, all of the troops arrived back there at their camp, and the American colonel in charge of these guys came over to us and says, hey, I just thought I'd let you know that one of our guys got hit on the head with a smoke grenade. And I'm going, oh, no. I said, how is he? And he said, oh, he's okay. He's got a dent in the helmet this deep, but he's okay. He was in the wrong area. He was in the wrong place. He was out of bounds, and so he wore this smoke grenade on his helmet. and he said, no apology needed. He said, no, he was in the wrong place. And so I got let off. But and then he turned around and he said, man, you guys are good. You guys are combat ready. Okay. Yeah, okay. How about that? Which is interesting because we never sort of thought of ourselves as combatants as such. We just did a job, you know. We did the military thing. Yes, we did all of the search and rescue stuff. We did all the other stuff. But we didn't sort of take the combat side of our job that seriously, I suppose, until this guy said, you guys are combat ready. And I said, well, thanks very much for that. That's a great accolade. So there you go. Yeah, exercises of all sorts were really good. Unfortunately, Triad fizzled out because of the nuclear policy, I guess, to some extent, and other things. But it's come together, and it didn't affect our exchange with the American Navy VXC-6 down in Antarctica, fortunately, because we did that every year for a long time. I don't know whether it's still going. I know that one or more seasons the New Zealand Antarctic Research Program was going to be really busy, so they asked if Niroquois could go down specifically for them, although they had been using VXC-6 aircraft. And the RNZAF said, yeah, that's okay. So they painted up these aircraft in the bright orange colour, and off they went, and they did a season down there flying the NZARP guys around. But that in itself was fantastic place to get a whole lot of different experiences that we could have never ever got by ourselves. And VXC-6 guys were really great to fly with and socialize with as well.
Yeah, and of course you also went to the Sinai Desert, didn't you?
Yes, now the Sinai Desert deployment was with the MFO, the Multinational Force and Observers, which was a non-United Nations established peacekeeping force set up mostly by the states because the Soviets had vetoed the UN going in there and keeping the peace between the Israelis and the Egyptians. And this was post the war that had happened in the Sinai, of course. And they'd come to this remarkable agreement not to shoot at each other any longer, and they accepted that they needed to have somebody independently going in there and just keeping tabs on the situation just to make sure that it didn't happen again.
Right.
And so this force was set up there, and it was for a period of 6 months for our guys. We did a rotation of personnel every 6 weeks. An aircraft from Australia or New Zealand would come up with the ANZAC component and take the guys that had done their 6 months home, and that happened every 6 months. It was a very, very interesting setup, and we made a lot of very good friends and did a lot of really good PR while we were up there with all sorts of people not only in the Sinai, but in Egypt and Israel as well.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid, Des, we're sort of running out of time here, but I know that you've got a lot more stories to tell. And as I've mentioned online in the past, I'm actually recording Iroquois stories from people who worked with the Bell Iroquois and the RNZF, and whether they were air crew or ground crew. And I know that you and I are going to record a lot more stories for that, and it will become a series within the podcast rather than the live show, where we'll have a bit more time to explore some of these things, like your time in Singapore and a bit more about the Antarctica and all that sort of thing. So I really want to say thank you very much for joining us today here on the live show and giving us a taste of what the Iroquois was like. It's been fascinating, and I could listen for hours.
And I hope that everybody that is listening have enjoyed what we've passed on today, because in our situation, we were a multi-role squadron that did absolutely everything, whereas in a lot of other countries, they split the roles up in various departments, and they never sort of mix up. So, yeah, that's why it was pretty special flying with three squadron on the Iroquois. Multi-role and multifaceted. It was a great experience.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Des, and we'll be back in another month with the Wings Over New Zealand live show in July. So, yeah, thanks everybody for listening, and we'll see you next month.